Didn't sing Sarah then. Okay, so let us continue this sutta. This is we're still going to working on Digha Nikaya 1. We've been looking at this for over a year now because I haven't been here very much. We haven't got very far on this sutta. But this is the very famous Brahmajala Sutta, which is mentioned elsewhere in the sutta. So it would have been well known also at the time of the Buddha himself. And the idea behind the sutta is to kind of capture all the wrong views that people have within philosophy, within religion, within the spiritual life, to capture all those views and then to kind of pave the way for right view, so to speak. Yeah. This is the idea behind this. And the sutta starts out with talking about virtue and about conduct in great detail, and we have looked at those things already on previous occasions. And then the Buddha said, well, people praise the Buddha for the virtue and the conduct. They don't really praise him for what he should be praised for. The Buddha should be praised for things that are much more profound than that. Virtue and conduct are things that you can see almost everywhere. You find virtuous people in all sorts of religious and spiritual traditions, even non-religious traditions. So the real things that the Buddha should be known for and should be famous for and praised for are his insight into the nature of reality, which means views. It's the Buddha's view of reality that really is special. And then we go through all of these wrong views. And so far we have looked at 8 of these wrong views. And now we come to the 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th of these wrong views is what is coming up now. And one of the kind of things to notice here straight away is that because we are dealing with views and some views are wrong, then there obviously is a right kind of view. And the right kind of view, anyone who is a noble one in the Buddhist teaching, is called dittipatto. And dittipatto means attained to view. You have sammaditti, you have the right view. And so in Buddhism, if you are a noble person, if you are a Buddha, you have a view. This is an important point, because sometimes in the suttas you read, as this is especially so if you read the Sutta Nipata in the Kuddaka Nikaya. The Kuddaka Nikaya is supposedly the short collection, but actually it's the longest one in the entire canon. It's one of those kind of nice little paradoxes, because it has grown a lot over time. And in the Kuddaka Nikaya, you find the Dhammapada, the Udana, the Itivuttaka, the various Jataka tales are in there, and lots of other books as well. But one of the collections you find, one of the famous collections that are in there, is the Sutta Nipata. And this is, that collection has 2 chapters in it that are ancient. They must go all the way back to the time of the Buddha, because they are referred to elsewhere in the suttas. And these are called the Attakavagga, the chapter of 8, and the Parayanavagga, the chapter of going across to the other shore. And very beautiful chapters. And in these chapters, especially the Attakavagga, you find this idea. This is all verse, right? These are verse suttas. And you find the idea that the noble ones go beyond views. And this idea, the feeling you get there when it says that, is that as if they don't have any views. That's the kind of feeling. And you have to be very careful, because unless you understand the context for these things, and the context for any sutta is all the other suttas, right? That's the context for every sutta, is all the other suttas. So you have to have an overall view. And especially when you come to things like verse, gathas as they're called in Pali, then you can expect that it's going to be, you have what they call, you have a certain leeway when you write in verse. You don't kind of write in ordinary prose style. And because you have a certain leeway, it means that it's not going to be as precise and accurate as what you find in the prose text. So straight away we know that the meaning actually is not that you don't have any views. It means they don't attach to views. That's the point. And of course, the reason why you don't attach to views is because you are dittipatto. You have attained to view. You know what is the truth. And if you know what is the truth, you don't have to attach anymore. if someone challenges you, you're going to say, okay, whatever, you can challenge me. I know what's true anyway, so it doesn't really matter. You're not really worried if other people challenge you because you know the reality of what is going on. So the Buddha has views. He has a viewpoint. That is precisely what insight is about. Is about seeing things in the right way and understanding the nature of reality. So this is what this is about. And that also allows the Buddha to know what is not right. Yeah. So this is what we're looking at now, this famous 62 kinds of wrong view. So now we come to the wrong views, number 9 to 12. And these are views about the cosmos, the loka, the world, being finite or infinite. These are the views about this particular area. And it is interesting, maybe straight away, just to... let's just read it a little bit before I start discussing the details here. So let's have a look at this a little bit more. So the views about the cosmos being finite or infinite. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who theorize about size. Or they theorize about, you can say, things being finite or infinite. And they assert that the cosmos is finite or infinite on four grounds. What are the four grounds on which they rely? It's when some ascetic or Brahmin, by dint of keen, resolute, committed, and diligent effort and right focus, experiences an immersion of the heart of such a kind that they meditate perceiving the cosmos as finite. Yeah, so it is a meditative experience that you base your view of the world on. And so because your mind has not been fully developed to experience some things as infinite, you see things as finite. An infinite perception in meditation is more profound than a finite perception. This is a more limited development of samadhi that we see here. So, you have this. So you have this sentence here of the kind of effort that you use. You're keen, resolute, committed, and diligent, and you have right focus. And many of these words are words that we find in the suttas. These are words like padana, which is the right effort on the Noble Eightfold Path, like atappa. Atappa is like the word you find in the Satipatthana Sutta, which means effort in connection with meditation practice. Diligent here is the appamada, the heedfulness or carefulness in a meditation. And one of these words is anuyoga. Anuyoga means just to practice, related to the word yoga. So these are all words that you find in the sutta. So the kind of effort that you do here is very similar to the kind of effort you find on the Noble Eightfold Path, because it is effort that is directed at achieving samadhi. So very similar to what you find on the Noble Eightfold Path, which is what you would expect. And then you have this little word, right focus, at the end there. And the right focus here is samma manasikara. Manasikara usually is combined with yoniso manasikara. But here we find the alternative phrasing, samma manasikara. Which is kind of interesting, right? I always find these little changes interesting. Why is it now samma? What happened to yoniso? We see yoniso almost everywhere else. Here we see samma. A few other places you find samma manasikara, and it is found in a similar kind of context as this, when we are dealing with wrong views and we are dealing with the attainment of samadhi. And the difference presumably is that samma manasikara, right attention, means that you have attention that is right to a certain extent, to the extent of attaining samadhi. But it's not yoniso. Yoniso means something that goes to the source. Yeah, it goes to the origin of things, the very root of things. And that is much more profound, because that is what takes you to the idea of non-self. You go to the root of what it is that we take as a self, right? Where does the sense of self come from? And when you look at that sense of self, carefully, you realize it is rooted in a delusion, because there's nothing there which deserves to be taken as a self. This is yoniso, goes all the way to the root of things, to what it, what these five khandhas, yeah, what our mind and body, what they really are like. So there's a small difference there in wording, but you can see the Buddha does not use the word yoniso manasikara, and I think that's precisely the reason why, because yoniso manasikara is then limited to what happens on the Buddhist path, when you have right view, you see things in the right way. Here it is instead called samma manasikara. Anyway, it's just a small little thing, yeah, but it's kind of fascinating, yeah. I don't know if you are... sometimes you see these little things and you think you get a bit excited. I was driving the other day with one of the other monks back to the monastery here, and I was kind of having my laptop, so I was sitting in the car and I was reading the sutta while in the car, and suddenly I saw this. I thought, oh, that's really cool. And I told the monk sitting next to me, and he looked a bit nonplussed when I told him about this. Oh, okay, really? Anyway. So this is a small little thing, but it's kind of interesting, because it shows you that here we are dealing with something which doesn't take you all the way to the end of the path. You experience an immersion of the heart. This is cetto samatha, yeah, or cetto samadhi, that of such a kind that you experience the world as finite. Experience here, interestingly, is the word pusati. Pusati is read as the word passa. Passa means contact, usually. And I sometimes wonder whether one should translate passa as experience. Because to me, experience is kind of, in some ways, easier to understand than the idea of contact. You experience things, and when you have an experience, then you have feeling, etc. Anyway, maybe I shouldn't get too sidetracked with these technical things. So that is what they do, yeah? And then what happens? They say, the cosmos is finite and bounded. Why is that? Because by dint of keen, resolute, and committed and diligent effort and right focus, I experience an immersion of the heart of such a kind that I meditate perceiving the cosmos as finite. Because of this, I know the cosmos is finite and bounded. This is the first ground on which some ascetics and Brahmins rely to assert that the cosmos is finite and infinite, infinite. Yeah. Yeah, working. Yep.
Is it up to the fourth jhana?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think it's a more limited kind of experience.
Oh, not even that?
Yeah. I would say usually the once you get into the jhanas, you get in, you know, some of these experiences are already going to be maybe not completely unbounded, but they can maybe be interpreted as infinite already at that point, depending on the situation. Yeah.
So I would say. Not even getting into the mark.
Probably not, yeah. Oh. Yeah, probably not. Yeah, I would say, yeah. So, but the, of course, the point, the interesting thing here is again the idea that you draw a inference, yeah, about the universe based on a meditation experience. You say the universe is of such and such a kind based on a meditation experience. And this is a very common mistake. Almost the whole world does that. You have a meditation experience, and based on that meditation experience, you say there is a creator God, or you say there is infinite consciousness, I have touched the ground of all being, and all these kind of things. And they come from these experiences. And you basically go beyond the data, and then you draw an inference, you draw a conclusion based on too limited evidence. You don't have the evidence to say these things, but it's so tempting to say it. Yeah, because it just seems so real, it seems so powerful, it seems like you have touched something really extraordinary and amazing. So yeah, very, very tempting to go and say, this must be the real reality. I certainly see nothing like it. Yeah, this is amazing, this is beyond the ordinary, this must be the truth. It's much more true than I've ever experienced before in my life, in my waking experience, in my sensory experience, whatever it is. And for that reason, this must be the real deal. Yeah, this is how you then come to this conclusion. But of course, the reality is that you have an experience, and then you come out of the experience, yeah, afterwards. And it is just a perception, really, mental perception. It is not necessarily a reality of the world or anything like that. It's very hard to, you know, it's very easy to overestimate these kind of things. Why is this view problematic here? This is kind of the interesting point here. Why does the Buddha count this as a wrong view? Surely, whether the universe is infinite or finite, who cares? Yeah, what has that got to do with views? Because later on the Buddha says, well, this kind of wrong view is problematic. It's problematic because it leads to rebirth. Yeah, that is the problem. It is a view which actually has bad consequences. And if you don't let go of this kind of view, you're going to carry on getting reborn, carry on, you know, moving from life to life, etc. And this is the problem here. So this kind of view has consequences. And that seems kind of strange, because you wonder, what does this have to do with the spiritual path? And the answer to that question is that, first of all, you know, when we talk about the world here, yeah, in Buddhism, when we talk about the world, usually what we mean is the world of experience. It's our inner life. Yeah. So, first of all, it's this idea, when you say the cosmos is infinite, actually what the cosmos is outside is kind of, it's not really a Buddhist view at all. It's kind of beyond Buddhism. Buddhism is all about our inner experience. So when we say the world is infinite, it would have to mean something like my inner experience is finite or infinite. And that kind of, I'm not sure if that makes any sense to talk about it infinite anyway. So this is maybe the first problem. But the main problem here, the main issue, is that when we talk about world in Buddhism, it is the same thing we were discussing before, is that when we talk about world here, usually it means like the self. Yeah, we were talking about Brahman and the cosmos being roughly equivalent. So when you see the cosmos, well, what you're seeing is a kind of a representation of the Brahman, the world spirit. Yeah, and of course the world spirit is just a way of thinking about oneself. Oneself ultimately belongs to that world spirit. These are not separate things. And in fact, what you see in meditation is precisely interpreted as the unification of your inner self with that world spirit. That's how samadhi would be interpreted in these kind of traditions. So when you say the world is infinite, or finite in this case, you're saying the self is finite. Yeah? And now you can start to see the point here, right? The point is really that it is an idea, a doctrine of self. And as far as doctrines of self are concerned, well, they are all wrong. They're all mistaken, because the self turns out to be empty, not to actually, you know, have any real existence at all. So you are still bound to the idea of a self, and that is really the problem here. So there's a number of issues. First of all, you know, the whole idea of a cosmos outside is kind of irrelevant. What we're interested in is the cosmos inside, experience. But more importantly, it is a problem of taking the self as real. And that, I think, is the one explanation that really matters in this particular case. Oh, you're getting many microphones. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just wondering about the immaterial jhanas, where is it consciousness that is infinite?
Yeah.
And why, when you're having the four grounds, it's mainly about being finite, and then the last one is finite or infinite, and how that view is different to what you might get in that immaterial jhanas?
I think when it comes to the immaterial attainments, then they would be considered infinite, yeah? And so that would fall into the category of infinite here, which is the next view coming up in a second here. And any experience short of the immaterial attainments probably be considered finite in a certain way. But it depends on the people, because these are often interpretations. Yeah, it depends on how you see them, and people might see jhana experience as infinite as well. because of the profundity. But certainly when it comes to the immaterial attainments, definitely that's where the infinite really, there's no doubt anymore. There's unbounded experiences. They're, sorry? No, they're not wrong. The wrongness is the interpretation. So you have this experience, immaterial, and then you say, the universe is infinite. That's where you go wrong. Instead of saying, I have this temporary experience, I go in and I come out of it, it's temporary, you say, the world is infinite. Because you are assuming a self there, which is without any limits. That is the problem. Interpretation is the problem, not the experience. It's always like that. So there you are. Okay, let's carry on to the second one. And what is the second ground on which they rely? It is when some ascetic or Brahmin, by dint of keen, resolute, committed and diligent effort and right focus, experiences a stillness of the mind of such a kind that they meditate perceiving the cosmos as infinite. So here we come to the immaterial attainments, perhaps. They say the cosmos is infinite and unbounded. The ascetics and Brahmins who say that the cosmos is finite are wrong. The cosmos is infinite and unbounded. Why is that? Because by dint of keen, resolute, committed and diligent effort and right focus, I experience a stillness of the mind of such a kind that I meditate perceiving the cosmos as infinite. Because of this, I know the cosmos is infinite and unbounded. This is the second ground on which some ascetics and Brahmins rely to assert the cosmos as finite or infinite. So the same as before, except that your meditation experience is a bit different. And it shows us very interestingly that even when you have experiences, experience itself is not enough. Experience also needs to be understood in the right way. It's so easy to interpret our experiences wrongly. So it's actually a very tricky area. Sometimes we say in Buddhism that everything is experience, and experience is all you need. But actually it's not really true. You also need someone to guide you. And this is the whole purpose of having a Buddha around, to say, actually, yes, you had this experience, but be careful how you interpret that. What does it actually mean? Is it really signifying that the universe is infinite without bounds? Or is it rather that you have this temporary experience that you go into and you come out of? And if you're going to be honest, well, all you really can say is that you have a temporary experience. You go in, you have it for a while, then you come out again. And that's really all you can ever say about these experiences. You can never say that they are eternal or infinite or anything like that. It's just a temporary thing. It's a perception of the mind, really. It's what it is. And this is what I would argue as well, that the idea of an eternal God is by definition something that you can never experience, because eternity cannot be replicated in any kind of experience. So the moment you say eternal God, like a creator God, you're actually speculating here, because it's impossible to have that kind of experience. Yes.
Am I right to interpret this as saying, if we do not have good guidance, even if we ever get into the Arupa Jhana, we are still stuck, and perhaps stuck even harder?
Yes.
Because the view will be very, very strong.
Exactly, But that's why, we have the sutta, so you already have good guidance, so if you get in there, you'll be all right.
Sure, I make a point. This is priority.
Yeah, absolutely, That's why they say that samadhi has to be supported by the other seven factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. That is when it's called samma samadhi. So without that, it's not really samma samadhi. So it's tricky. Yes?
Command option plus.
Command option plus. Okay, well, now this is really good. Okay. Oh, still going out of the screen, I think. Command option minus. That doesn't work. Command shift minus. Okay, got it back again. Thanks. Nice try. Okay. So that is the second one. So it is very, it's a bit repetitive, but now let's go on to the third view. And what is the third ground on which they rely? It is when some ascetic Brahmin, by dint of keen, resolute, committed and diligent effort in right focus, experiences a stillness of the mind of such a kind that they meditate perceiving the cosmos as finite vertically, but infinite horizontally. They say the cosmos is both finite and infinite. The ascetics and Brahmins who say that the cosmos is finite are wrong. And so are those who say the cosmos is infinite. The cosmos is both finite and infinite. Why is that? Because by dint of keen, resolute, committed, and diligent effort and right focus, I experience a stillness of the mind of such a kind that I meditate perceiving the cosmos as finite vertically but infinite horizontally. Because of that, I know. The cosmos is both finite and infinite. This is the third ground on which some ascetics and Brahmins rely to assert that the cosmos is finite or infinite. Okay. So let's move on to the next one. And what is the fourth ground on which they rely? It's when some ascetic Brahmin relies on logic and inquiry. They speak of what they have worked out by logic, following a line of inquiry, expressing their own perspective. The cosmos is neither finite nor infinite. The ascetics and Brahmins who say that the cosmos are finite are wrong, as are those who say that the cosmos is infinite, and also those who say the cosmos is both finite and infinite. The cosmos is neither finite nor infinite. This is the fourth ground on which some ascetics and Brahmins rely to assert that the cosmos is finite or infinite. These are the logicians, and you can pretty much hammer out any kind of conclusion through logic. Yeah, you just have to have the right kind of starting points and assumptions or whatever, and then almost anything can be argued in this world, as we can see by looking at the history of philosophy, probably. Not that I'm a philosopher, but that's what it seems like sometimes. So it is neither finite nor infinite. Not sure what that means. Don't know what that would mean. What does that mean? Does it mean, don't know what it means? Yes. Yeah.
So, first of all, I understand that the world, the universe is created by the mind. And
yeah.
The mind is the strongest force, yeah? And space-time comes second, right?
Mm.
It's the stiffest material known to human, yeah? And so it's created by the mind, first of all, yeah? Which is why this is important, yeah? But it's saying here, because I do know at the time of the Buddha, India is already very strong in science and mathematics.
Yeah.
It's well known, yeah? And he's criticizing that, yeah. And at the same time, we all know about 10 billion JWST, which is currently the focus of the world, and especially my profession as well.
Yeah? Mm.
And this is a direct rebuke?
No, it's not. It's not a rebuke. The point is just that logic is, of course, we need to use logic because logic is one of the tools of, you know, coming to conclusions about things. But it's also to understand the limits of logic. The limits is the assumptions that go into the logic. Yeah? It's like, you know, you have mathematics, you have certain axioms at the root of mathematics. And if you change those axioms, which you can, yeah, then you get a different kind of mathematics. Yeah, so your results are built into the assumptions that you make, the axioms that you have, and the results come from that. And in Buddhism, it's exactly the same thing. And one of the axioms that we bring with us into all our perception, all our understanding of the world, is the axiom that we have a sense of self, that we have a self. That's the axiom, yeah? Because we can't see the world without that. And once we bring that assumption into our building of theories, building of views, building of ideas, hammering things out with logic, because it's built on a false premise, we're going to get false results. So this is really what this means, really. So that's why we have to be careful with logic. It doesn't mean we should not have logic. We should understand the limits of the logic. This is what comes, you know, when you go back to the famous Kalama Sutta, yeah, where the Buddha says to the Kalamas, don't rely on tradition, don't rely on lineage, don't rely on inferential reasoning, don't rely on logic, basically, what he's saying there. Don't rely on the teacher, yeah, don't rely on me, right? don't rely on anything except personal experience. That's what he starts out with. And then, once you have a certain degree of personal experience, and you know that the basics of the teaching are right, that is when you start to, okay, now I can build a little bit of logic, and I can listen to the teachers, and listen to the, you know, the canon a little bit, because I have some foundation on which to, you know, okay, this teacher seems to be telling the truth, because it fits with experience. So, in many ways, it comes back to the idea of experience. And then you have to combine that with the idea of listening to a teacher, and then combine it with logic as you practice further down. But it's very difficult, and it's very easy to go wrong, precisely because some of our basic assumptions are faulty at the very root. And if there may not be any teacher around who tells you the truth, in which case you have a serious problem. Yeah, you may not be getting anywhere at all. And this is the kind of problem in life. Yeah.
Because I do know that many of the great Chinese or other monks and monastics, they talk about one of the underpinning experiences, the whole universe come crashing down.
Sorry, can you say that again?
One of the kind of this kind of like entry experience, right?
Yeah.
Is that the whole universe?
Yeah. Right.
Come crashing down.
Right, exactly, because everything you thought you knew actually turns out to be false, exactly, so everything comes down. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense. Yeah. Okay. So those are the four, yeah, about the finitude and infinitude of the universe. These are the four grounds on which those ascetics and Brahmins assert that the cosmos is finite or infinite. Any ascetics or Brahmins who assert that the cosmos is finite or infinite do so on one of these four grounds. Outside of this, there is none. The realized one understands this. If you hold on to and attach to these grounds for views, it leads to such and such a destiny in the next life. He understands this and what goes beyond this. Yeah, so again, this idea here that if you have these views, it leads to rebirth, because you are grasping onto something. These views don't come without grasping. You're attaching to something. What you really are attaching to here is, again, the idea of a self. And that is the problem here. So it leads to rebirth. In other words, it leads to the continuation of suffering. He understands this and what goes beyond. Yet since he does not misapprehend that understanding, he has realized extinguishment within himself. Since he does not grasp, since he does not grasp that understanding, there's no holding on. He just knows it because of direct insight. He is extinguished. This is what nirvana is like. Anupadesesa nirvana. Anupadaya, how's it go again? Whatever. He realizes nirvana without grasping here. Having truly understood the origin, ending, craving, drawback and escape from feelings, the realized one is freed through not grasping here. And this again is one of those very interesting points, because it draws together two things that seem to be very separate, feelings and views. Yeah, this is one of the things I mentioned on Friday night's talk as well, is that actually there is a clear connection between feeling and views. And that is that the reason why we tend to hold on to certain views is because they make us feel good. Yeah, it is part of our outlook. Sometimes our views are part of our identity. I'm a Buddhist. And if you kind of challenge my Buddhist views, I'm going to get upset I'm a Buddhist because I feel good to be a Buddhist. Yeah, it's true, isn't it? Once you are convinced that Buddhism is a good teaching, the Dhamma is good, well, once you are convinced about that, then it feels good to be a Buddhist. You want to be a Buddhist. And so it feels good. Yeah. Or maybe you have a nationality. Yeah, you are Australian. Yeah, don't say anything bad about Australia. Actually, I don't know if anyone here thinks like that, but you know, sometimes people think like that. My nationality, don't say anything bad about us. Yeah, we are good. We are the best. Yeah, we are, or whatever it is. And so, challenging our views are always bound up with feeling, yeah? And they come with feelings. And you can see that when people challenge you, you feel defensive, you don't want to admit or whatever. Yeah? And so this is kind of the point that he's making here. And by understanding that those feelings are unreliable, impermanent, they depend on contact and all of these kind of things, you realize that actually the whole view itself is just so uncertain, so unreliable. Yeah? Feelings change a little bit, and suddenly you take another view, right? Because another feeling arises instead. Suddenly you start feeling happy. We feel good about Christianity. Yeah, Christianity actually feels quite nice, yeah? You have a God who is always there, you can always rely on. In Buddhism, nothing to rely on. It's always kind of, everything is so shaky. I think Christianity better, yeah? It's better to have kind of a God who is always reliably there, yeah? I think I might as well change over to becoming a Christian. Huh? So it can happen, right? We can know lots of people who started out as Buddhists and they become Christians. Not because, you know, unfortunate, but that's what happens sometimes. Like my father told me many long time ago, my father was a businessman. He traveled a lot around the world, everywhere, and kind of, you know, he was in the shipping business. And at one time he was sitting, he had some kind of dinner after some kind of business deal that was made. And then he was sitting next to this lady. And this lady told my father that she used to be a Buddhist, but now she had become a Christian. And my father asked her, why? And she said, Christianity is a much better deal. Yeah. All you have to do is believe. Yeah. In Buddhism, you have to work really hard. You have to be nice and all these kind of things. That's what he said to him. So it feels better. If it's a better deal, then it feels better, right? That's kind of what it comes down to. Sorry, please. Yes.
Me again.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, so let's say you were to have an experience and then you had the wrong view and it takes you years to come to Dhamma class and find out these concepts.
Yeah.
So you get a conceptual view, a trusting view from a monk. But how do you refine your view? Do you then go with that logical thought and when you experience things and when you come out of some experiences, you think in a different way with that new view and then you refine it? Or is it experiential or can it just be like a trust thing?
It's all kinds of things, yeah. It is experience coming together with understanding how the Buddha looks at the world, using your also thinking about it, reflecting about it. So reflection, or you can call that inferential or indirect knowledge, experiential knowledge, and then the confidence in the word of the Buddha, all of these things coming together, and they grow together, yeah? These are not kind of separate things. They kind of grow together, all of these things.
So do you see the view mainly from the three characteristics and impermanence, suffering, and no self.
That is the main thing. That is the view. Yeah.
Okay.
So you have to apply that view in a way which is meaningful to you. I think one of the mistakes that we often make in Buddhism is that we make it too theoretical. Maybe a bit like today. Maybe this is too theoretical. But we need to apply it in a way whereby it really bites. It really has an emotional effect on us. You measure the effectiveness of what you're learning by the emotional effect it has on you. So when you're seeing dukkha, you don't just see dukkha by, you know, reading, oh yeah, five khandhas of dukkha, oh yeah, I understand that. No, you don't understand that. If you put it that way, if you really understand that the five khandhas are dukkha, it has a powerful emotional effect. You reject it. Yeah, you think, oh, I don't want to touch it anymore. And this is why it's a gradual movement. So you think about the world. Okay, the world is... This is why I like to talk about the world very often. I say the world is a bit out of control. The world is doing all kinds of funny things. Do you really want to attach to that world, which is so out of control? Do you want to hope that the world is going to be nice and beautiful in next year, 10 years' time, 20 years' time? And if you attach to that idea that the world is going to be a great place to live in 20 years' time, you're probably going to suffer a lot, yeah? Because you are holding on to something which is very uncertain. I haven't got all that much faith that as humanity, we are capable of, you know, chaperoning this planet in the right direction. You wonder, maybe we will do it, maybe we won't, but it kind of looks very uncertain sometimes. And so you don't want to hold on to something which is so unreliable. And this is what I mean by having an effect. And when you start to see that, actually, okay, let me do more spiritual practice, because that is where I really create my future, is in how I live my life. So you have to do things that are, right view means something which has an emotional effect on you. And it actually makes you act in a different way. That is the real right view. Sometimes in Buddhism, we are too theoretical again. I believe in rebirth and karma, so I got right view. Not really. That is just a very intellectual right view. If you just take it that far, what does it mean to believe in rebirth? What does it mean in terms of your relationship to the world? Yeah, this is kind of the critical thing here. And once you get that, that is actually when you know, things have an impact on you. So the same thing with all of these things here. Ideally, you know, they come back to this idea of having an emotional and real impact on you. It shifts the way you relate to things. That is when they become important. Okay, so... feelings, yeah, are the problem. So when you understand that those feelings, they have an origin, they have an ending, they arise because of conditions, they are dependently arisen through dependent origination, they're nothing internal, well then your foundation for your views are also dodgy. From views, yeah, dependent origination from feelings, you have craving. From craving, you have upadana. Upadana is grasping. One of those graspings is dit upadana, grasping to views. It comes through feelings. So if feelings is unreliable, then the whole idea of grasping views is itself very unreliable and very unsatisfactory. Okay. These are the principles. We've seen this before. I will repeat a little bit because it's so rare that we have a chance to look at this. So these are the principles. Principles here is Dhamma, deep, hard to see, hard to understand, peaceful, sublime, beyond the scope of logic, subtle, comprehensible to the astute, the wise, which the realized one makes known after realizing them with his own insight. And those who genuinely praise the realized one, in other words, the Buddha, would rightly speak of these things. Yeah, so these are the deep things, the deep dhammas. And I just want to make the point, which I made recently. This is quite a nice little sequence there, or words. Yeah, deep, something is profound. Why is something profound? It is profound because it takes a deep mind, a mind which is incredibly still, incredibly powerful to see these things. It is rare for people to have these kind of mind states. Can't really have it apart from deep meditation experiences. It's profound in that sense. It takes a profound mind to realize it. It is hard to see because it takes that profound mind state, which is hard to take sort of practice to achieve. Hard to understand is just another way of saying hard to see. Dur anuboda. Anuboda means to awaken to. Yeah, Bodha, Bodhi, awakening. Yeah? Hard to awaken to. But then it talks about peaceful and sublime. This is Santa Panita in Pali. And so this shows you that in Buddhism, anything that is truly profound, yeah, is also very positive. It is something that is very attractive. Peaceful and sublime, these two words are used for the most profound and beautiful things that we attain on the Buddhist path. They are called peaceful and sublime. So when things are profound and deep, they're also very, very incredibly attractive. And you're drawn in towards these things. This is where you understand, this is what I've always wanted. This is what life is about. This is what I've been searching for all the time, but I've been looking in the wrong place. Here it is. So attractiveness, beauty, something being really delightful, all of that comes together with profundity. Beyond the scope of logic, or beyond the intellect that I have translated as, these are not things you can think yourself to. You have to experience directly when the mind is super duper still. That's where you see these things. You have to get out of the thinking mind. And this is why sometimes the field of philosophy is never going to grasp these things unless it uses these experiences as part of the input into that philosophy. Subtle, very delicate, very subtle things, comprehensible only to the wise. Pandita is the Pali word. Pandita Patisangvedi or something like that. I can't remember what the Pali is now. So you have to be wise to get there as well, right? You have to be wise to become wiser. It's catch 22, isn't it? Makes it hard. So there you are. So this is the people who philosophize about the world being finite or infinite. Any comments on that? Does anyone here think the world is finite or infinite? Please, Conrad. Yeah.
It's. I wonder. I've heard Ajahn Brahm say before that enlightenment's possible wherever the Eightfold Path is practiced. And I wonder about different traditions, like the Christian mystics, who have pretty similar sounding experience to the jhanas.
Mm.
Is it possible to become, an arahant or fully enlightened through a different tradition?
Depends on. Remember, the view is the significant thing here, right? Right view is the beginning of the Noble Eightfold Path. So, if you are a Christian, very likely you will think of a Creator God as some kind of permanent essence in the universe. And then, when you come to the jhana, you say, "This is it. I found the Creator God," because it has those characteristics that you normally give. That normally you would say a Creator God has: a feeling of permanence, of bliss, of selflessness, and all of these kind of things. It's all there. So you very likely, maybe with the exception, if you have some very special definition of the Creator God, which is very kind of as emptiness or something like that, maybe you can make that leap. But I think generally speaking, if you are a Christian or you because you have already you come with a burden of a doctrine, when you come to that position, it means that you are unlikely to make that last step.
Okay. Do you think it's possible, though, say if there was a bit of support in having a different idea of God, or God being something perhaps non-self-like? Because I've read some of Rumi's stuff, and some of Rumi's stuff sounds kind of non-selfish, the way he might...
Well, if you say God is nothing, if God doesn't exist, then maybe you can say, but that kind of goes against the idea of God. So I would say it is, unlikely, unless you are a very inquiring person. You are someone who starts out with a Christian view, but you're also very open-minded, so that when you come to these insights, you're actually able to go beyond your original view. That is maybe the only possibility, a bit like the Buddha did, perhaps. Okay, let's move on to the next grounds. These are the equivocators. So these are people who don't take positions. Yeah, they don't take any specific position. Equivocation. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who are equivocators. whenever they are asked a question, they resort to evasiveness and equivocation on four grounds. What are the four grounds on which they rely? It's when some ascetic and Brahmin does not truly understand what is skillful and what is unskillful. They think, I don't truly understand what is skillful and what is unskillful. If I were to declare that something is skillful or unskillful, that would be falsehood. That falsehood would be stressful for me, and that stress would be an obstacle. So from fear and disgust of false speech, they avoid stating whether something is skillful or unskillful. Whenever they are asked the question, they resort to evasiveness and equivocation. I don't say it's like this. I don't say it's like that. I don't say it's otherwise. I don't say it's not so, and I don't deny it is not so. That's pretty useful doctrine. This is the first ground on which some ascetics and Brahmins rely when resorting to evasiveness and equivocation. It's almost strange, because it's almost like you are an ascetic and Brahmin, but you don't really have a teaching. Yeah, you just have this, yeah, I don't say that, nor do I say the opposite, nor do I say neither one nor the other, nor that, nor... It's just kind of this endless refusing to take any kind of standpoint about anything. This is really the point here. And one of the teachers in India who did this was Sanjaya. He was one of the famous teachers, and apparently he was one of these equivocators, and he seems also to have been the teacher of Venerable of Sariputta and Mahamoggallana as well. So they started out with this kind of skepticism, where they wouldn't take a stand on anything, and maybe that is what eventually led them to the Buddha, because they didn't have any strong kind of doctrine that they were following. But in a way, this is quite nice, because you realize your own limitations. You realize, I don't understand what is skillful and unskillful. And this here is kusala and akusala. And this can be meant in many different ways. It can mean skillful and unskillful in an ordinary way. Don't really understand what is moral and what is immoral. It can mean what is skillful and unskillful in a higher sense, to do with meditation, how to get into deep samadhi, for example. Or it can mean in the highest sense, so what is skillful and unskillful in terms of views and insight into the nature of reality. So it has a very broad application here. But here is a person who at least is truthful, they're not, which is obviously a very good start point for getting somewhere. And they don't want to speak falsehood. If they're saying here, if I were to say this is skillful, this is unskillful, well, actually, it would be like telling a lie in a sense, because I don't really know. I'm pretending that I know when I don't know. And that would be, what does it say here? That would be stressful for me, if I kind of lie. Lying is not bad. So they obviously have some idea about what is skillful and unskillful, because they know that lying is unskillful. They obviously have some idea here. And lying, stress, would be a obstacle. Obstacle for what? Well, whatever that they're trying to achieve. Samadhi, going to heaven, whatever. It would be an obstacle to progress on the path, really. So, in a sense, this is kind of in some ways, quite a nice thing. But from the Buddha's point of view, it's actually not really helpful. Because it is, it means that you haven't really understood the nature of reality. These are people, you could say, that don't really have a view at all, or they have the view that they don't have a view, whatever it is. But they don't have a view, and this is obviously not what the Buddha, this is not the Buddha's position. The Buddha does have a view. So again, this shows you that the Buddha actually has a position. He has a view, because these people who don't have a view, they are wrong. This is not the right way of thinking about the world. Yes, sir. So wait for the microphone. That's good.
So, am I right to summarize this in modern language, that these are people, they know that they do not know.
Yeah.
And in modern understanding, these are already people who are 50% on their way to success. Not 100%.
Yeah.
They're halfway through.
Yeah.
They're in good shape.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say so. Yes, Jack?
This could be a follow-on question. Yeah. The eel wriggler, is this the eel wriggler?
Yeah, this is the eel wriggler.
Oh, this is eel wriggler.
Yeah, yeah.
I heard from a talk online that eel wrigglers, either in the commentary or in the text, there were some rather scathing remarks about eel wrigglers being either cowards or stupid.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Well, that is probably part of it. Yeah, this is one. Actually, we'll come to that one soon, because these are four different reasons for being an eel wriggler, and one of them is the stupidity and dullness. Yeah, that's quite right. And cowardliness, I think that's another one, because they are afraid of debate, and they realize, actually, I'm not really good at debate. Other people are going to tear me apart, so I better shut up, otherwise I'm going to be in serious trouble. So, yeah, there's some truth to this idea of cowardness and dullness. Absolutely.
Isn't it also a case that the irregulars have got pride, or it's basically an ego thing with them, that they don't want to look stupid?
Yeah, exactly. That's similar to what Jake was just saying. Yeah, that you are afraid of being not being able to stand up for your viewpoint, and that's why you know. So it could be an ego thing. Yeah. So there's something underlying this. So there's many different reasons for this.
A follow-on question.
Yeah.
The term agnostic, would that be equivalent to an eel wriggler?
I guess it depends on why you are an agnostic. Everything in Buddhism is about motivation. What drives that kind of point of view? So if you are an agnostic because you truly realize that, actually, I don't know, well, then I would say no, then it's okay. But if you are an agnostic because you are afraid of kind of debating anyone, well, then, you know, then it is a problem. It's a bad motivation. So it depends. So just like the eel wriggler here, it is a... It depends on where you're coming from, whether it's good or bad, I suppose. Okay. So I think in this case here, it is quite a positive kind of eel wriggling. Yeah, you are afraid and disgusted with false speech. I mean, that's it's quite noble. But there are reasons that are far less noble than that, as we shall see in a second here. What is the second ground on which they rely? It is when some ascetic or Brahmin doesn't truly understand what is skillful and what is unskillful. They think, I don't truly understand what is skillful and what is unskillful. If I were to declare that something was skillful or unskillful, I might feel desire, greed, hate, or repulsion. That would be grasping on my part. That would be stressful for me, and stress would be an obstacle. So from fear and disgust with grasping, they avoid stating whether something is skillful or unskillful. Whenever they ask the question, they resort to evasiveness and equivocation. I don't say it's like this. I don't say it's like that. I don't say it's otherwise. I don't say it's not so. I don't deny it is not so. This is the second ground on which some ascetics and Brahmins rely when resorting to evasiveness and equivocation. So here the idea is, it seems, perhaps two different ways of understanding this. The idea is that once you take a position, about what is skillful and unskillful, you have, in other words, you take a viewpoint on this, then other people might challenge you. And when they challenge, other people might have an opinion about what you say. They might praise you. Oh, yeah, you're really good. Yeah, you're doing the right thing. And yeah, this is a good view you have. And then you feel desire for that position that you have. You grasp that point of view because other people praise you. Everyone wants to be praised. Yeah, everyone wants to feel good about themselves. And if people say that you are the best, yeah, you are super duper, then of course, you know, you're going to feel really happy about that. Or people might say, you're crazy, you're nuts, how can you say such things? And then you're going to get angry because of that, yeah? And then that anger also is a kind of you have grasped that view because you have taken a position. Taking a position means you're grasping these views, and then you get angry and upset if other people are challenge that. So that's one way of thinking about this. Another reason way of thinking about this is that when you say that something is skillful and unskillful without really knowing, the fact that you do that usually comes from a defilement. Yeah, you want to you want to shine. You want to you have some desire there underneath this. And so that is why, from that desire, you say, yeah, this is skillful, this is unskillful, without really knowing. And then you have to defend yourself, yeah? You have to defend your position in the future when people challenge you. And you get into a lot of trouble because you are coming from desire. You're coming from all of these kind of... you're coming from... something which isn't really pure or isn't really good, nothing to do with the spiritual part. It all has to do with ego, with self, and with desiring praise and these kind of things. And that becomes the thing which drives you rather than the finding the truth or whatever. So you don't want desire and greed, yeah, or anger to infiltrate your views. Because once it does, then you have a problem. So they are afraid of this. And again, this is fairly wholesome, yeah? They understand, I shouldn't really act out of desire or anger. So maybe I'll just be honest, I don't really know. Why should I take a position if I don't know? Let me just be quiet. Yeah, so they say these kind of things. They could have said, I don't know, but instead they say all this other kind of stuff. I'm not sure why they do, but that's what they do. Okay, what is the third ground on which they rely? It is when some ascetic or Brahmin doesn't truly understand what is skillful and what is unskillful. They think, I don't truly understand what is skillful and what is unskillful. Suppose I were to declare that something was skillful or unskillful. There are clever ascetics and Brahmins who are subtle, accomplished in the doctrine of others, hair splitters. You'd think they'd live to demolish the convictions with their intellect. They might pursue, press, and grill me about that. I would be stumped by such a grilling. That would be stressful for me, and that stress would be an obstacle. So from fear and disgust with examination, they avoid stating whether something is skillful or unskillful. Whenever they ask the question, they resort to evasiveness and equivocation. I don't say it is like this, I don't say it's like that, I don't say it's otherwise, I don't say it's not so, and I don't deny it is not so. This is the third ground on which ascetics and Brahmins rely when resorting to evasiveness and equivocation. So here they are afraid of argument. Yeah. Now this is getting maybe a little bit less kind of noble, yeah, because you are afraid of other people, attacking your position. It is here, you obviously, maybe you even have a kind of a preference, but because of your attachment to your view, you don't want other people to attack you. But really, sometimes I think it's healthy to have a view. Yeah, you have a view about things, and if other people do challenge you, it's a good thing. You listen to what they have to say. You see it maybe as an opportunity to grow. Yeah, oh yeah, that's interesting. You have a point there. So maybe I can learn something from this. Maybe I can grow my own understanding. Yeah. So being challenged isn't... We shouldn't get defensive when we are challenged. Challenge is a possibility, potential for growing and expanding our understanding. Yeah. So sometimes it is perfectly okay. So here it's more defensive. It's more... ego defense mechanism that is going on, and that is obviously not so good. Let's go to the last one. What is the fourth ground? Oh, let's finish this one first. Sorry. Yep. What is the fourth ground on which they rely? It's when some ascetic and Brahmin is dull and stupid. Because of that, whenever they are asked a question, they resort to evasiveness and equivocation. Suppose you were to ask me whether there is another world. If I believe there was, I would say so. But I don't say it's like this. I don't say it's like that. I don't say it's otherwise. I don't say it's not. So I don't deny it is not so. Suppose you were to ask me whether there is no other world. Whether there is both is and is not another world. Whether it neither is nor is not another world. Whether there are beings who are reborn spontaneously. Whether there are they are not beings who are reborn spontaneously. Whether they both are and are not beings who are reborn spontaneously. Whether neither are nor are not beings who are reborn spontaneously. Whether there is fruit and result of good and bad action. Whether there is not fruit and result of good and bad deeds. Whether there both is and is not fruit and result of good and bad deeds. Whether there neither is nor is not fruit and results of good and bad deeds. Whether a realized one exists after death, whether a realized one does not exist after death, whether a realized one both exists and does not exist after death, whether a realized one neither exists nor does not exist after death. If I believed there was, I would say so. But I don't say it is like this, I don't say it is like that, I don't say it's otherwise, I don't say it is not so, and I don't deny it is not so. Don't worry if you if you didn't follow everything. These are just kind of various kind of ideas which are considered as some of these statements are considered right view in Buddhism and others are not, and there's kind of various constructions. This is the fourth ground on which some ascetic and Brahmins rely when resorting to evasiveness and equivocation. So again, yeah, this is obviously not a good one. You're just dull and you don't really kind of, maybe don't want to think it through, and you're perhaps a bit lazy, and maybe you shouldn't be having any arguments at all, and you shouldn't really pretend to be a teacher. You should probably just remain quiet and practice quietly. This is then the result of all of that. So a lot of this comes from the sense of self. Yeah, it's kind of fear of being challenged by others, and fear of perhaps appearing dull and stupid or whatever. And because of that, all of these things are also problematic. You haven't really understood what is going on, and because of that, this position too, we will see in a second, also leads to problems. These are the four grounds on which those ascetics and Brahmins who are equivocators resort to evasiveness and equivocation whenever they ask the question. And the ascetics and Brahmins who resort to equivocation do so on one or other of these four grounds. Outside of this, there is none. The realized one understands this. And those who genuinely praise the realized one rightly speak of these things. So in between there, in the middle, you have this whole thing. Yeah, he understands this. If you hold on to or attach to these four grounds, yeah, this you hold, attach to this idea that I don't say this, I don't say that, the idea of not having a view, that is this equally problematic as having all of these other kind of views. Yeah, because that is also a kind of view, the rejection of all of these views, not being able to take a standpoint, having a sense of self which underlies all of this, and then you get reborn accordingly because of that. That is the problem there. It's kind of interesting that this equivocation has the same problem as a view. Yeah, you cannot really escape. The only way to escape is by having right view. All of these other things are either wrong view, or they are defense mechanism of the self, or they are some kind of view in one way or another, and for that reason they lead to rebirth as well. Carrying on of samsara. Any thoughts on this? No thoughts? Okay. No views? Is that right? Equivocation. I don't believe this is true, nor do I not believe it is true, nor do I neither believe it is true and true. Okay, so this is a question from... Yeah, please. You're going to need the microphone now. I think the online people will be very happy if you use the microphone.
My point in all of this, listening to it all, is that sometimes we just don't have views.
Don't have what?
Sometimes we just don't have views on things.
Yeah.
Either because we haven't thought about it or whatever. So, I mean, you know, it's...
Yeah. But this here is, these are people who actually have a kind of, they have a position, yeah? Their position is not to have a position. Huh? That is a position, because these are ascetics and Brahmins, these are kind of professional, spiritual people who actually take a particular position. But for someone who doesn't have a view, that's perfectly okay.
Why do they have to have a view all the time?
They don't have to have a view, but but it's almost as if they are professionally taking a non-view, yeah? This is kind of it is a kind of view. It is a view of not having a view, if you know what I mean. That in itself becomes a position and becomes a kind of view in its own right. And then that view leads to rebirth. The point is not here to say this is bad. The point is just to say that this leads to rebirth. It leads to a continuation of dukkha. It doesn't end the samsara. It makes samsara, the journey of rebirth, carry on. Yeah, that's kind of the point here. But it may be a good starting point for getting a right view. Yeah.
Mm.
So it may be, some of these things may be more useful than others for moving towards a right view. And saying that you don't know, I think, is a very good starting point.
Yeah.
If you have a lot of strong opinions about things that might block you from, they might actually block you from moving forward in the right way. So not having a view is often a very good starting point. But actually, it is impossible not to have any views. But you don't have any maybe such strong views or whatever, but some kind of views are going to be there as part of who we are, basically. So, yes. Okay. So let's have a look at these questions here. So this is from Yong. I don't know if I know. Maybe I know one Yong. If it is you, Yong, that I know, then hello. If it is not you, then still hello. So hello. Bhante, other religions are simple. Believe and you go to heaven. Simple and attractive. In contrast to Buddhism, that seems a very hard path. What is the value of Buddhism to you? Okay, so Buddhism is actually quite simple. It's just that I'm very bad at making it simple. That's the problem. And but Christianity is incredibly complex. If you were to come to some kind of course about Christianity like this, Christianity is unfathomably complex. And if you look at the history of Christianity, they have something called theology. Theology is the study of Christian doctrines and trying to figure them out. It's supposed to be one of the hardest things you can do in the world is to understand Christian theology. Yeah, so it's just that the reason why you think Buddhism sounds complicated is because you have only touched Christianity on the surface while you're trying to understand Buddhism more deeply. That is why, because Christianity is actually much more complicated. Maybe not more complicated, but it's very complicated. And on top of being complicated, I'm not sure if it makes sense. Yeah. And this is really the critical thing. Does something make sense or not? That is the issue that is important. Is something true or not? That is what matters. So ask yourself some very simple questions. When you practice the Buddhist teachings, when you live well, when you do the right thing, does it lead to the results the Buddha promises you? And if it does, then maybe take a step further. So for me, the reason I believe in the Buddhist teaching is for me, I think they are incredibly sensible. I grew up in a Christian society. I could make no sense, no headway with Christianity at all. It didn't make any sense to me. And because it didn't make any sense, I didn't have any choice but to reject it. Whereas the Buddhist teachings, to me, make a lot of sense. Yes, it demands more. Yes, it demands more responsibility. But when you take responsibility of your own, for your own life, that actually is enabling. Yeah, it is empowering. Whereas the idea that some God is going to look after you, great if it turns out to be right. If it turns out to be wrong, well, you have a serious problem. So I think it's far more attractive to look after your own life. And to me, unfortunately, the idea of a creator God does not make any sense. It seems to be completely extraneous to existence. Anyway, that's certainly my position. Another one from Yong. Bhante, is the topic theme of DN1 similar to MN1, the Mula Pariyaya Sutta? Yes, there are similarities because the Mula Pariyaya Sutta is about also rooted in the problem of misunderstanding of the world, where you yourself you see your sense of self in relation to various kind of things. Yeah, and that is part of that wrong view, similar kind of wrong view that we're seeing now. So they are related. There it is more seeing yourself directly, whether yourself is, you know, is of a certain type within the five khandhas or within the samsaric existence or whatever. So it is more directly related to the sense of self. Here it is more directly related to viewpoints, but it comes back to the same thing really at the end of the day. Maybe we can do the Mula Pariyaya Sutta one day, but it's quite a tricky sutta. From Nalina, saying that a bhikkhuni tradition has died out and not wanting to have any views on this because of fear, is this skillful or unskillful? Thank you, Ajahn. If it is because of fear that you don't have a view, I would argue that it is not skillful. Anything that is based on fear is not skillful. But if you don't have a view because honestly you don't know, and a lot of people, it's hard to have an opinion about these things because they can be quite difficult and technical, or you can have an opinion in general because you feel that this is the right way because it was the right at the time of the Buddha, etc., etc., then I think it is perfectly acceptable. You don't necessarily have to have a view based on strict scriptural understanding because very few people will have that. But based on fear, yes, then it is a bad idea. But be circumspect. Don't have too many views too easily because that just makes things more uncertain and it's dodgy in its own right. Okay, let me. There's another question here, but let's put that aside. Let's just see if I can finish. I want to do a little bit more before we call it finish it off. So there's only two more views to go through. Okay, next here are doctrines of origination by chance. And this is how the world comes into existence by chance, is the idea here. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who theorize about chance. They assert that the self and the cosmos arose by chance on two grounds. And what are the two grounds on which they rely? There are gods named non-percipient beings. When perception arises, they pass away from that host of gods. It is possible that one of those beings passes away from that host and is reborn in this state of existence. In other words, here, among humanity. Having done so, they go forth from lay life into homelessness, and by dint of keen, resolute, committed, and diligent effort and right focus, they experience a stillness of the mind of such a kind that they recollect the arising of perception, but no further. So the idea here is that you think back into the past, and there comes a point when you come to your life, when you lived as a non-percipient being, you can remember up to the point when you emerged from that attainment, you emerged from that rebirth, when perception re-arose after being gone. But then before that, it's just black, it's dark, there's nothing, because there's no perception. That's kind of the idea behind this. So you remember past lives to that point. And because there is nothing before that, then you conclude. They say the self and the cosmos arose by chance. Why is that? Because formerly I didn't exist, but now, having not been, I have sprung into existence. This is the first ground on which some ascetics and Brahmins rely to assert that the self and the cosmos arose by chance. So again, you have some experience, very interesting experience, the asanya satta, non-percipient beings, And so you have an experience, but then again, you overinterpret the data from that experience. And you think that the data mean that before this point, there was nothing. Yeah, I didn't exist, nothing existed, and it was always like that. But if you had gone back further, you would have seen that actually there was another life before that, yeah? And it could go back even further into the past. So it is a mistaken inference based on certain experiences. That is the problem here. The world coming into being. Non-percipient beings. Kind of weird, isn't it? Asanya Satta, they're called in Pali. I don't even know what to say about them because they sound so strange. How can you even exist? What does it mean to exist if you have no perception? I'm not sure what to say, so I'll just not say anything here. Sounds wise, doesn't it? Is it out of fear or is it out of dullness and stupidity? I'm not sure. Probably one of those. Okay. So what is the second ground on which they rely? It's when some ascetic and Brahmin relies on logic and inquiry. They speak of what they have worked out by logic, following a line of inquiry, expressing their own perspective. The self and the cosmos arose by chance. This is the second ground on which some ascetics and Brahmins rely to assert that the self and the cosmos arose by chance. And this is quite an interesting one, this last one here, because I think this is a very modern outlook. If you think about modern cosmology and modern physics, it is basically what modern scientists are saying. They're saying that the world came into existence at the Big Bang. Before that, there was nothing. Suddenly one day, bang, it came into existence. And then everything started from there. Yeah, this is essentially what they're saying. It's a bit different because they are working on a physical world, whereas the person here are probably working more on a, I don't know it's what they're working on, but they're working more on kind of the self and the world, yeah, so it's a bit kind of it's more like a kind of unified whole whereby self and world are two aspects of the same thing, yeah. But it's similar in the idea that things suddenly came out of nothing, yeah. And that, of course, means that modern cosmology, with the idea of the Big Bang being the beginning of everything, it's wrong from a Buddhist point of view. That can't possibly be right, yeah, because things don't just arise out of nothing, suddenly coming into existence. In Buddhism, there's always a prior cause, always something before that. And I think most modern cosmologists also are not really satisfied with this idea that suddenly things come into existence, because it kind of doesn't make good sense. And I remember there was a cosmologist who said some years ago, he said something like, give us one free miracle and we can explain everything else. It's not really satisfying for a scientist to say, give us a free miracle. Yeah, that's what he said, because that was the Big Bang moment. That's the free miracle. And from there on, we can explain everything. But we can't explain the Big Bang. Yeah, it just happens. And it's interesting. There is, if you look at a little bit about cosmology, there is there are cosmologists who work on an idea of cosmology called bouncing cosmology. There's actually a whole website called Bouncing Cosmology. There are certain, star cosmologists who work on these ideas. And so there is an idea in modern cosmology which are working on very similar principles to the Buddhist idea that the cosmos goes in big cycles, yeah, bouncing back and forth, like pulsating almost. And that is a serious branch of modern cosmology which is working on that. I think that there is evidence in the suttas, the Buddha seems to have said that this is the way the world works. So because, I have a lot of confidence in what the suttas say, I think that modern science is actually going to come to the same conclusion eventually, unless they give up on the whole project or they, whatever. I think that we're probably going that way. That's what I would say here. because that's really what we have in the suttas. Suttas have this idea of no beginning. Everything always have a cause. So it makes good sense that things should be cyclical. It's really only when things are cyclical that you can have this going on and on and on without conceivable beginning here. Yes.
I do think that we talk about the consciousness in modern cosmology.
We don't. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
We do.
Oh, we do.
It's a very fundamental concept. Consciousness is a very very and a very argumentative field.
Sure.
It's more problematic than cosmology. There's heated argument when it comes to consciousness, and where does it come from?
Yeah.
And again, the Buddha will rebuke that discussion.
Indeed. So I agree with you. But normally, if you look at, I think, the usual descriptions of the Big Bang so far, they kind of leave consciousness out of it usually, and they think of it more like a physical conscious universe.
It's a product of that. It's a product.
Okay.
Because without consciousness, the whole thing will not work.
Yeah, because you need to observe. So you mean the kind of the quantum effects only exist because of observation or whatever? Yeah.
It's a very problematic.
Okay. So that is the origination by chance. Yeah, very similar to some of the ways we look at. It's kind of fascinating because when you start to look at all of these grounds that Buddha is talking about here, he's basically criticizing so many of our contemporary ideas of the world. This is really a criticism of modern cosmology. It's kind of extraordinary. We have seen before the criticism of a creator God. These are views we looked at before. That idea is criticized, which means that the Buddha was critical of any religion which deals with a creator God, which is kind of exceptional. Then we saw before that he's criticizing the idea of a universal ground of consciousness, the Advaita Vedanta, the kind of the Hindu or Brahmanical idea of how the world is, the self and the cosmos being one, and all of these kind of things. So when we start to look at these views, we actually can really see how this is almost all modern views that we have about the world are actually included in the criticism that the Buddha is making here. Which is kind of extraordinary. This happened 2,500 years ago. So it's kind of amazing that the Buddha had that kind of outlook. And it shows, to me, it just shows that, he had a very profound insight into reality. Because he had that profound insight into reality, it means that any views that don't fit that will automatically be discarded. So all he has to do is to kind of make those points, and they will automatically fall by the wayside because they don't fit with that insight of the Buddha. Yes, please, Ananda.
Exactly. Ajahn, thanks. That non-percipient beings, on that one, out of the 9 meditative attainments, I think there is one, what is it, nevasanya, nasanya, and that neither non-perception nor unperception, something like that. And if someone, say, without any Dhamma knowledge, without Sutta knowledge, without right view, gets stuck in that kind of meditative attainment and don't reflect on it, and that it is impermanent, non-self, and suffering. Could they be the ones that get born there?
Yeah, the thought occurred to me as well that might be the beings, because that is a realm you cannot reflect on. I don't know if you remember, if you go back to the suttas about how to attain awakening, you can attain awakening from any jhana state or immaterial state except for the nirvasana nasanya yatana. The neither perception, non-perception realm, because it is too subtle. You can't really think about it properly because it's so subtle. So you cannot use that as a basis for insight. And because of that, it seems possible that this actually is what is meant here. But according to the commentaries, what this means, the asanya satta, it means based on the fourth jhana, you have the desire to be reborn without perception because you don't want to perceive anything. Yeah? And then based on that, you then get reborn without perception. Yeah? That is apparently the commentarial explanation of this. Yeah? But I was thinking along your lines, I must admit. So who knows? But yeah.
And the second one, Ajahn, that these are, did you say 62 views, I think?
Yeah.
And these must be all the views that existed among all these people like Sanjay Biryat, yeah. Buddha and Ajit Kesambhala, all these people would have been holding on to these views at that time.
Yeah.
So Buddha is busting those myths.
Sorry, Pa?
Busting the myths.
Busting the myths, yeah. Busting the myths. Yeah, exactly. Myth-busting, yeah.
Myth-busting.
Yeah.
So would it be right to assume that these are all the views that existed at that time among the...
Yeah, quite likely, because where else would the Buddha get this, you know, from? I mean, it would be a practical thing of, you know, as you say, like, yeah, so we are... Yes, yeah, so I'm very glad you're saying that idea of busting myth, because that gives us a good precedent, yeah, with myth busting, yeah. So thank you for that. But yes, and I think that is exactly what... I don't think all of those views are included here, because some of those views were very simple views, like not believing in karma, for example. And that is... not fully included here. These are more high views, yeah, views about samadhi experiences and about the eternal lasting of the mind and God and these kind of things. These are more profound doctrines. I think there are some simple doctrines in the sutta that are not actually covered by these things. But
I think there is one view, I don't know whether before this or after this, yeah. That very view that Bhikkhu Sati held on to.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
That
yeah.
You may, I think maybe after, down.
Yeah, yeah, this so consciousness which transmigrates and carries on forever and ever, whatever. Yeah.
There's the ear and the body and they are, what did you say, that they are impermanent. Yeah. The consciousness is permanent, that it transmigrates.
Yeah.
So those are things probably that existed at that time.
I would think so. I think that's why they're here, yeah. So absolutely, yeah. 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 Yes, please, we talk. Yeah.
So about these non-percipient beings and the reflection and all the experience, we are talking of absolute high achievers here, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And they are still stuck.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's pathetic. Yeah. Very sad.
It's sad. Well, yes, in a sense.
These are absolute high achievers.
Yeah. So if they
because
had...
even if it's, you're talking of the argument which I've seen here, the high-level argument there, is whether it is the eight jhanas or the first jhana. So we're talking about argument among the absolute high achievers.
Yep. So lacking in right view. They've got everything except for right view. Lacking that spark. You know, it's interesting in the Arya Pariyasana Sutta, the Noble Search, Majjhimanikaya 26, where the Buddha thinks, who should I teach first? And he says, I should go and teach Alara Kalama, yeah, because they were my teachers, and they will understand quickly. And then he finds that they have passed away, and they've probably been reborn in some kind of very long-lasting Devaloka somewhere. And then he says, well, their loss is a great one, because they would have understood this teaching quickly, yeah? So this is what you're saying. They were high achievers. They had deep samadhi. But before they had a chance to be taught, they had been reborn in some kind of realm. And that's exactly what the Buddha says. Can't reach them because they are stuck in a jhana state or something. Yeah. Okay, let's finish off the this thing here, and then we will call it a day. So, these are the two grounds on which those ascetics and Brahmins who theorize about chance assert that the self and the cosmos arose by chance. And the ascetics of Brahmins who theorize about chance do so on one or other of these two grounds. Outside of this, there is none. The realized one understands this, and those who genuinely praise the realized one would rightly speak of these things. These are the 18 grounds on which those ascetics and Brahmins who theorize about the past. It's a bit unclear why all of these things have to do with the past, but let's not worry too much about that. We get the general idea of the theories. Assert various hypotheses concerning the past. And the ascetics of Brahmins who theorize about the past, do so on one or other of these 18 grounds. Outside of this, there is none. The realized one understands this. If you hold on to and attach to any of these grounds for views, it leads to such and such a destiny in the next life. This is the problem with holding on to views and grasping views. He understands this and what goes beyond this. Yet since he does not grasp that understanding, he has realized extinguishment within himself. Having truly understood the origin, ending, gratification, drawback, and escape from feelings, the realized one is freed through non-grasping. All these views come from feelings in a certain way. Even the eel wrigglers, they want to feel good, so they eel wriggle out of negative feelings. But that leads to problems. These are the principles, deep, hard to see, hard to understand, peaceful, sublime, beyond the intellect, subtle, comprehensible to the wise, which the realized one makes known after realizing them with his own insight. And those who genuinely praise the realized one would rightly speak of these things. Okay. So, please, Barbara, yes. Yep.
Getting back to the earlier thing about Christianity,
yeah.
I was a little bit confused, confused, when you said about rejecting Christianity because it didn't make sense to you.
Mm.
And what came into my mind is, well, yes, I was born a Christian, I went to church, but I've been following Buddhism for 40 years now, practicing to the best of my ability. But what came into my mind is, well, what about Jesus, the teacher? He gave very, very good teaching, I feel. And so I didn't think it was nice to sort of reject that part of it.
Yeah.
Well,
no, it's fine, of course. No, it's perfectly okay. No, the thing is that, first of all, I would say a lot of Christian people I respect because they're really good people. There are a lot of things in Christianity that was very interesting, like some of the saints and some of the deep religious practitioners that you saw in the Middle Ages, for example. People obviously had deep insight into things. They had some mild experience in many things. There are many things in the Bible that are inspiring. There are many things in the Bible that are really uninspiring, but there are certainly some inspiring things there. And Jesus, as a person, probably was a very interesting person. He probably had some very interesting things to say. So, I don't really mean to kind of throw out everything in Christianity and say it's all bad. My feeling is just that some of those doctrines that you are taught in Christianity did not make any sense to me. And the whole idea of a creator God to me was never really made any sense. And I just kind of rejected it fairly early on because I thought this makes no sense to me. So, that's really, but you're quite right. There are many good things there, and let's not throw everything out with the kind of let's make a distinction there.
Yeah. Rejection, and well, that's what other people are thinking as well.
Yeah.
And Jesus came into my mind. Well, that was good teaching there for people.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. No, that's a good point. So thank you for bringing that because we don't want to be too harsh or too kind of.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so we have one more question here from Katerina, and she says, Dhamma made me feel like if I have a view, I have to stand for it, care for it, fight for it. Easy to accept there are different opinions, and not to pick any, flow with decision, which is right. I think it's a bit of both, yeah? I think it's good to have a view. I mean, views are important. In fact, we cannot live without views. And we all have views because views is an extension of having a sense of self. Yeah, we have views about things. And even if you don't have a sense of self, still you're going to have a view because there are certain things that just are reality. So views is a part of existence. But it's really how we deal with those views that is important. And the view that you want to have, ideally, is something which is as close to the Buddha as you can get, because that is what, by definition, is right view. So to get close to the view of the Buddha, it is good to have flexibility in your own views. Because if you hold on too harshly, too fast to your own views, then you're going to lack that flexibility of mind to move towards how the Buddha saw the world. And remember that unless you are a noble one, you're going to have some aspect of wrong view. Yeah, there is no such thing as full right view unless you are a noble individual. That those are the only people who have the full right view. So the right view that you have is only a partial right view at best. Yeah, even though you may think you believe in rebirth or karma and all these kind of things, still, it's going to be partial. And the reason it's partial is because you haven't fully seen the nature of reality yet. So be flexible. Don't argue about your own view. Yeah, you can argue a little bit in a gentle way, just because you want to have a discussion or whatever. That's okay. But don't get heated about it. Don't get emotional about it. Yeah, because once you get emotional and heated about it, it ends up into a quarrel, a fight, an argument. Yeah, it shouldn't. That is where we go wrong. Yeah? And as the Buddha says, he doesn't argue with anyone in the world. Yeah, he presents the Dhamma, and if people want to argue, well, okay, it's their problem. It's not the Buddha's problem. Yeah? And that is really ideal. Yeah, the ideal is that we very often, instead of just having a view and accepting that it's okay, it's good to have a view, we grasp onto it, we make it an extension of our personality. This is my view, this is who I am. And then if someone challenges that view, we feel like our personality, our sense of self is challenged. And that is where the problem arises. Yeah, it's me that is challenged. So make that distinction in your own life. Try to see when it gets too hot. When it has to do with your personal feeling about you, it is defilement basically coming out. That is when it is problematic. And have that flexibility with things. And understand that even if you have right view, understand that there is a distinction between your temporary view and knowledge. Your view comes mostly from confidence in faith, quite likely, unless you are a very, very developed person. And accept that, yeah? It is not the full and final reality that you have. So that you also just have a view. And then you become a bit more humble about things when you do that. So find that middle way. Have views. Don't allow other people to just bully you, or maybe bully is the wrong word, but persuade you all the time. That's also wrong, because other people don't have any better view than you have. Quite likely you have a better view already. Yeah, so don't allow that either. But find a middle way whereby you cannot trust your own judgment. You have views about things, but you don't hold those views in a very tight way, so that you feel challenged, you feel personally challenged every time someone discusses with you or whatever.
Would you
have
a follow-up comment over there?
Please, yes.
My question is, when you still have a concept of self and the wrong view, you still get some happiness and pleasure out of that. For example, the concept of that the cosmos is infinite, or your consciousness is infinite.
Yeah.
And even the jhana experiences maybe show you that. So then why is nature in a way that even something that's not true or inherently true still enjoyable? And still leads to some sort of happiness, short-lived maybe.
Mm.
But why does it do that? Because then it's really hard to find the truth.
It's because of delusion. Yeah, the delusion. If you gratify the delusion, the delusion is happy. Yeah? It's like what is it like? It's a good question. I don't know. It's like you, I don't know, but the problem is that you have a feeling of a self, yeah? And that is the delusion. And if you gratify that feeling of self because you have that delusion already, that makes you feel happy, because something which you think is there gets gratified. And that is the kind of the problem here, Yeah? So you gratify something that seems to be there, but actually it is not really, it is not true, and so it makes you feel happy for that reason. I was going to try to find a simile, but I can't really think of anything now. Huh? Yeah, something like that. Yeah. Okay, we've been going for a long time, so I apologize for going a little bit over time. So, any last comments? No, everyone okay? Yeah, okay. Nice to see you all, and I wish you all a wonderful week ahead. And let's just pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha before we go.